Talk given Friday, 21st March, 1975. The last time we met here, we considered matters of very great importance to anyone who is truly concerned with living the religious life. It can never be repeated too often that the religious life, in the real sense, is not to be separated from the secular life. And the religious life means the human life in the full and perfect sense of the word human. Whereas our secular life, even to this day, after some millions of years of evolution and development, is still very much at the subhuman level. We considered also the difficulty of living the religious life in the milieu which the world offers us, wherever we may be. It is extremely difficult, extremely trying, always defeating us. And there is one important point in this connection we must never forget, which I'm afraid we all too often do forget. The milieu which the world offers includes us. I myself am a contributory source to the nature of that milieu. It's not as if I am different and the world is different from me and the world makes it difficult for me. I too make it difficult for the world and make it difficult for myself. We are born ignorant. We are born incapable. We have to learn to grow. And in this process of learning and growing, those around us who are supposed to guide us are themselves in difficulties. They themselves are ignorant and incapable. Devoid of true self-knowledge to start with. Not having a proper human spiritual compass so that they can set their sights correctly upon that which we are slowly becoming. And in very simple terms, that which we are slowly becoming is summed up in that single word, God, speaking theistically, speaking in more philosophic terms, the perfected Holy One. That is to say, the pure one, the one whose mind is mature, the person who is an integrated unit in himself. And not only an integrated unit in himself, but integrated into the world structure, even though he may not be, and in fact, if he is truly human, he will not be of the world. Now, these are very deep and very important things. It's easy through familiarity with the subject to talk about them. It is so easy for the intellect to give assent to it. But it's quite a different thing for the whole being to live by it, fully awake to all its implications. And you may recall, last time, we laid emphasis upon the importance of constant mindfulness and constant attentiveness. Attentiveness, the right sort of attentiveness, is the means for the diagnosis of what is ill within oneself, and simultaneously it is also the medicine. None of us have attentiveness in the real sense. We are partly awake and rather too largely asleep. We are deliberately feckless often. So all these factors prevent true attentiveness. This power of attentiveness, if it is at a white-hot level always, is the power that affects that psychical transformation in us, which releases our true human nature into perfect fulfillment. The person, person with a capital P, if you like, the Purusha, as it is put in the Sanskrit of the Upanishads, is one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. And note always that where all the deep religious teachings are concerned, they are concerned with the mind. You can use the word soul if you like. You can use the word spirit if you like. They are not, on the whole, specifically directed to the body as such. For the very simple reason that through the ages, that is to say, the historical period, as far as religion as we know it nowadays is concerned, roughly say 6,000 years. Throughout this period, it has been well understood that man is essentially a mind being. If the mind is rightly nurtured, then the whole organism, the body-mind organism, is healthy and whole. Because it is the mind that exercises the directing power from within us. And the directing power from within us, if truly pure, clear-sighted and powerful, if that directing power is of that nature, then all the obstacles dissolve away. The difficult situations are resolved in the right way. But we must not presume to predetermine what is the right way. This is where our great difficulty comes. Because we have the power of imagination, picturing things, we tend, in fact we invariably do, we make a picture of the future in terms of what is pleasant for us, what we would like it to be. Even to make a picture in terms, in purely qualitative terms, supposing our picture is no more concrete than saying we would like a future where there is, where we see truth and purity and beauty, love and wisdom flowering, and stop short at with those words. Nevertheless, in the deeps of our psyche, we have our own pictures of what is meant by love and beauty and so forth. And those pictures are always restricted pictures and restrictive pictures. We are not capable of taking in the totality. And this is the great point. When attentiveness, through the discipline of constant mindfulness, when attentiveness reaches this white-hot peak point, then all those pictures are burnt up. Recall Moses and the burning bush. When all the pictures, the mental constructs, all the mental impressions deep down in the unconscious itself were all burning away. That doesn't mean they were being destroyed. They were being transmuted. The energy which they represent was being transmuted. And the soul, the mind, the psyche, use what word you like, of Moses was in the utterly pure state. Then out came the voice of Elohim, of transcendence itself. You see what communion means. Where there is the fulfillment of the human, there is the state of permanent communion. And this is where these two elements, purity and attentiveness, and if you like to reduce it to one element, attentiveness, complete attentiveness, because you cannot have that complete attentiveness without the purity. Where there is complete attentiveness, you are always in the state of communion. You, the particular finite individual organism, is in that state which offers no resistance whatsoever to totality in its fullness, its transcendence from functioning through you, through that particular psychophysical organism. In this state, that particular psychophysical organism, I, John Brown, am no longer self-conscious as John Brown. You must not forget that. No longer conscious, no longer self-conscious in that isolated sense. Then the whole living being is God incarnate, to use a theistic term. It is in the state of the perfect samadhi, to use a Hindu-Buddhist term. It is, I like to use in modern English, in our modern world, it is in the state of perfect communion. Now, let us listen to this very, very carefully, because I doubt if in my lifetime I shall be able to put this in clearer words. When one is in that state of communion, it is transcendence itself which is looking through my eyes at all objects, at all persons, all creatures. The person, the object, is finite, mortal, limited. But transcendence itself looks through my eyes at the object or the person, sees the person in his or her wholeness, and sees infinity in the person, the totality in the person. Try and be very sensitive to this. Through your own eyes, in the state of communion, transcendence, God, Brahman, the totality, use what word you like, sees both the particular and the totality in fullness. That distinction between the part and the whole is out. That is to say, the separative distinction is out. And therefore, you see, this is the state of absolute unity, is it not? This is the ultimate meaning of communion. I can't put it in clearer terms, I think. And I doubt if it will ever be possible for me to put it in simpler, more lucid, clearer terms than that. This is the meaning of communion. And you see, the whole purpose of the religious life is to arrive here, is to flower out into this. And this, as far as I can see, is the peak point of humanity. This is what man is. Now you see why. Both in India and in Western Asia, Palestine, such a man was called the Brahma Putra, the son of Brahma. In Christian language, the son of God, the son of man, the son of mind, come to fulfillment, to full adulthood, to perfect maturity, is identical with the son of God. Transcendence itself. Sense this deeply, quietly. Don't accept my words. Don't reject them out of hand. Just let the mind be at peace and see into this. There are extraordinary significances and implications involved in what we are trying to see just now. When transcendence looks through my eyes, through your eyes, when you are in perfect communion. Then Browning's phrase, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world, is an absolute truth. The intellect cannot possibly formulate that, cannot grasp that, for the very simple reason that the intellect grasps only because there is limitation, there is measurability, there are criteria, evaluations, judgments, and so on. But the totality has no criteria, no judgments. The totality is the totality. How can it judge any one part and decree reward or punishment to any one part? Those are all the concepts of the blind. Blind in transcendent terms. Now, when transcendence looks through your eyes and sees in the finite person totality embodied, what sort of love is there? Can we talk about it? Impossible. What sort of relationship is there? Is it the relationship of particularity, of a subject and an object? No. This relationship is union, where the subject-object differentiation has absolutely vanished. Now, if you can take this when you are by yourself, recall the words of Jesus, love ye one another as I have loved you. The love which you cannot think about, talk about, imagine, picture, try to express. It transcends all that. It is the absolute eternal reality itself there. There is nothing to think, talk, try to grasp or anything. It is the absolute fact. Absolute love liberated into its fullness. As I have loved. If one is in communion, then one is in the state of complete and perfect harmlessness, isn't one? And if one is in the state of harmlessness, has not one also seen the whole truth about the person, the situation, and so forth? And this is bliss. This is beauty. Bliss and beauty which we cannot define, but which you yourself will embody and actually know and experience. Your knowing will come when the nature of physical existence brings you back into the ordinary state of consciousness which prevails when the senses are functioning and one's discriminative consciousness is at work. One's discriminative consciousness has to be present when you are moving about physically. But here is something which is little known. There are hints in the Upanishads which lead to this. There are hints in Tibetan Buddhist statements which would make this clear. If ever you had a touch of it, in actual experiencing. There is no separation anywhere. So that in your waking state, and even when you are functioning in terms of the senses and discriminative consciousness, you are totally free of all evil. Not evil as I conceive it and define it, but something which goes right beyond all that. That is why the presence of the Holy One through the ages, especially in those parts of the world where people care for these things truly, the presence of the Holy One is a benediction wheresoever he is. But we have to wake up to this, haven't we? How often people say, oh, I wish I had been there when Jesus walked the land, or the Buddha spoke to his bhikkhus, or whoever it is. Had I been there, clever fellow that I am, I should have had all sorts of wonderful criticisms of the things he said. All sorts of arguments and questions to defeat the Holy One. In the Buddhist records, we have these people come. In the New Testament, we have the Jews come along to Jesus and try to catch him out. And what happens each time? He, the embodiment of the truth of love, exercises such an influence naturally that these people see themselves for what they are. And they are usually bowled over, as we say, in ordinary parlance. But never for a moment does that infinite love, that infinite truth, that perfect wisdom which is completely natural to such a man, never does it waver. Never is it at a loss. He hasn't got to search for wisdom, to deliberately exercise wisdom, or to maintain the state of absolute love. It is there naturally. Like, naturally, there is air and space and light and so forth in nature. You see, I want to emphasize as strongly as possible, let us not try to picture this situation. Because whatever picture I try to make of it will invariably bear the defects of my own conditioning. The imaginative faculty, the image-making faculty, is a conditioned thing. You can't make an image without the conditioning. But this is beyond all conditioning. You recollect how often we have used this phrase, you know by being that which you know. You are that which you know, which you observe in mind and consciousness. And you are it in mind and consciousness, not as a mental construct in your brain, but in this mysterious transcendent reality of total mind, like total space. You are it. There is no differentiating. There is no separating out. And yet, the marvel and the mystery of infinite, unique particulars is also manifest. You see, we are in a dimension of being and consciousness which speech and discursive mind cannot reach or touch. That is why in the Upanishads it is said that from which speech and mind return, not having realized. And yet this indemonstrable, absolute reality can only be, I'm going to use the wrong word, can only be framed in the mind by the mind. That means not making another mental construct merely of it. But the mind is of the stuff of awareness. And when the infinitude of mind is in full awareness, only infinity, the absolute, the totality is present. Without destroying the fact of particulars. It's difficult, isn't it? One mustn't struggle intellectually to grapple with it. That's the wrong way. When you are out in beautiful woodlands, lovely, clean, fresh air, sunshine, what do? You just enjoy it, as we say. That is to say, you are living it in communion. This is enjoyment, not pleasure. Mere pleasure-seeking, sensational, exciting pleasure-seeking is the activity of the immature, to put it at its kindest. It is the activity of the stupid, to be a little more accurate. It is the self-indulgence of the utterly wicked, to put it at its worst. So now, let us come back to this state where transcendence sees, hears, touches, and also thinks and feels through the living organism, which has utterly transcended all isolative self-consciousness. This is the state of communion. This is the nature of communion. Now, we talked about this intensity of attentiveness. Everybody wants to know, how do I become so intensely attentive? What is the way? To use the Sanskrit term samadhi, is supposed to be attained, achieved, thus and thus and thus. Now what I have said so far should make it clear that communion, that the state of samadhi, the state of the fullness of contemplative prayer, the unio mystica, whatever you like to call it, is not an exclusive something. It doesn't exclude anything. It doesn't try to include everything within itself. Because the moment the mind starts thinking in these terms, I have separated out myself and the rest. I'm just bloating myself to include the cosmos. If anything, it's the other way around. It's the cosmos which contains me. The cosmos is embodied in me, but I don't contain the cosmos. This must be carefully realized. Therefore, there is no exclusiveness involved. The idea of going through a procedure by which this desirable result shall be attained has no place whatsoever in the reality of communion. None whatever. This samadhi, this unio mystica, just supervenes through the intensity of attentiveness. Now you'll still be asking, how do I get at this intensity of attentiveness? Whatsoever the eye sees, let it see totally. Whatsoever the ear hears, let it hear totally. How do I hear totally, see totally, feel totally? By being free of the interposition upon the seeing or the hearing of all my concepts, my beliefs, my ideas, convictions, the naming process, the talking process, the process by which I grasp something because I like it, or try to destroy it because I dislike it, and so forth and so forth. See, communion is here now, not to be attained, therefore, tomorrow, next week, 10 lives hence, and all that rubbish. See, when I talk in terms of 10 lives hence, or 3 lives hence, or etc., etc., what am I doing? I'm grasping tight at my concept, which has no warrant in terms of ultimate truth or ultimate reality, of an I am I, which is an unchanging entity. This is the point. But you see the implication of that. It feels a very cruel, a terrible thing. The world has believed, I shall meet my loved ones after death, and so forth. All right, if I look forward to meeting my loved ones, I cannot say no to the hated ones. And supposing they are also there all the time, what then? And in fact, they are there all the time. Because, as we know only too well, nothing can be thrown out of the cosmos. And our particular context in this cosmos is the one filled with all the things that we draw to ourselves through either what we miscall love, which is just attachment and grasping, or which we also hate, because that also is a power that binds. The ambivalent love-hate, both of them bind the individual. If I'm going to meet my loved ones, I will have to have all the wretched ones also there with me. No escape from it, no nonsense. So you see, all these illusions, they have to be out. Otherwise, transcendence cannot look through my eyes or hear through my ears. And when transcendence looks and hears, this looking and hearing has no relationship to the ordinary, everyday looking and hearing in terms of discriminative consciousness, in terms of attachments and aversions, conflicts. This is the supreme harmony then. When transcendence looks and hears through me. You see, the intellect feels very grand. When transcendence looks at me, I see the finite object and also see infinity embodied in it. Nice words. Grand ideas. I myself have put them out. I know. How else can I convey it to you? But in conceptual forms. But I'm trying to point out what you have to beware of. All these mental constructs inside oneself, all the attachments, all the aversions, all the vasanas, as they call them, the unworked out impressions from the time one is born onwards in the mind. The rubbish heap of the unconscious, if you like. You see, that is all there, making the mind really such an opaque rubbish heap that the light of transcendence is hidden. Now you will appreciate why the great teachers, if they taught anything definite, they taught this: be pure, be clean. The sealers, the moralities, the commandments. The whole of the practical aspect of religion is just this. The mindfulness and the intensity of the attentiveness purifies the psyche. And this purification of the psyche also means an actual change in the very brain cells. Your very nerves and everything change. There is a real transmutation of the person. Then this wonderful thing is present, unobstructed by this particular manifestation, oneself. See, it's very important, and I'm sure you will see it quite clearly yourselves. It's very important to be able to set your sights correctly. If you set your sights on a will-o'-the-wisp, well, there is only sorrow and pain. But if you can set your sights with at least some sort of psychological awareness of the meaning of reality, of the meaning of being truly human, then all one's energies are not misdirected. Otherwise, in the name of the best and the highest, we are constantly misdirecting our energies, which is a tragic, pathetic thing. Because we are well-meaning. We do not, all of us who meet here, there's no need to question the sincerity and the good feeling behind it, underlying it. But that is not enough. There must be intelligence also. There must be perception also. And perception does not mean subscribing to a doctrine. Because merely subscribing to a doctrine means that you are subscribing to a fixed mental construct, which is an obstruction to reality. Reality is too great to be held in my petty little construct. But if the mind is lighted up at all, then what ideas it throws out just naturally throws out. Because the mind never ceases throwing out ideas. Then whatever ideas the mind throws out will have some sort of link, some sort of relationship to reality. That is why I say so strongly again and again, don't hold on to the idea, but that which the idea is trying to light up, to indicate. Communion is a living experiencing. An idea, a thought, a concept is an excrescence. It's excreta, mental excreta. It has its place. The excreta of this kingdom of nature is the food for that kingdom, and so on. What is thrown out of one kingdom is food for the other kingdom. There's a marvelous nurturing process going on this way, so that ideas and thoughts and aspirations and everything, they all have their place. But don't grasp them, because then you'll be grasping at that which has ceased to be a source of health, of wholeness. Let them go. Awareness, consciousness, being awake is not an idea. It is a state of being which defies any description. You can't constrict consciousness in reality. Now, I've said a lot this evening. It is this kind of realization by the Holy Ones which is the source, the wellspring, the eternal wellspring of all the great religious teachings of the world. The teachings are particularized expressions of this kind of livingness. And our race has been blessed not only by just five or six great founders of religions, but by tens, by scores, by hundreds of perfected holy ones who have lived through the ages. If you look through the sacred literatures of the world, you will find any number of names. One has to know how to find out. If we take the Old Testament, we have names like Enoch, who they say walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. What does that mean? See? In the light of what we have been trying to consider today, you will find real enlightenment there. Elijah and the name Enoch, to start with, means the teaching. It also means intuition, the teacher. Elijah, Eliyah, God himself. God as the strong one, the syllable El or Eli stands for the power, the creative power of God, of transcendence. God the strong one. God himself, Eliyah, the chariot in which he goes up to heaven. Is not this realizing of this livingness of communion the meaning of being taken up to heaven in a chariot of fire, the fire of the Spirit? Look at the meaning of resurrection and ascension. Centuries before the birth of Jesus, in the Aitareya Upanishad, you find Vamadeva, who was one of the great holy ones. In fact, he's the reputed author of the fourth book of the Rig Veda. They say, absolutely in so many words, in the Aitareya Upanishad. And Vamadeva, having said this, ascended aloft and became immortal. Yea, became immortal. And you see, there are hundreds of names like that. If you take St. Luke's Gospel, and in the third chapter, he starts the genealogy of Jesus, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, who was the son of Adam, who was the son of God. Get the meaning? There are 77 names, I believe, in that list. Rather interesting. 77 names. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you find two lots mentioned. It's the same lot mentioned twice. In the second... When it repeats the second time, there is a slight difference in the actual names given. And every one of those names has a meaning, has a profound spiritual meaning. And it ends up, who is the son of Brahman, Svayambhu, the self-existent. You find this sort of thing, you know, throughout the great teachings of the world. The sons of the prophets, for instance, and so forth. They are the perfected holy ones. And they have blessed this earth with their presence and their teaching. This is your destiny, not your personal destiny. It is your divine destiny. Because the totality, transcendence, realizes itself as totality through you as a finite particular. It is the fulfillment of God through you. It is transcendence which comes to perfect fulfillment as man through the human psychophysical organism. So it is the divine destiny which is fulfilled through you, the particular man. If you really understand this, all questions about free will and predestination just fly out of the window by themselves. The breath of life, of eternal life, is so powerful a wind that it throws all these tomes out of the window. You see what it means then, in terms of freedom for each one of us as we live here in the world. The freedom of the mind. And this, if you can let yourself enter into it, just enter. Don't try to enter. Just be quiet. It will take you into itself. This is the great thing. It will take you into itself. If it will take you into itself, it means that all that we try to do, because we are concerned with religion in the true sense, has happened.